Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 41, Novels as Spycraft 7, Dashiell Hammett, Part 2, A Hard-Boiled Marxist. Today I'm recording from Hard Scrabble Farm. Side note here, I'm not sure I wrote it in my notes, but I learned something. Apparently hard-boiled, obviously it refers both to the way of cooking eggs, but it sort of came into prominence during World War I, when it referred to being good under, like, maintaining your composure under fire, which is interesting. So Dashiell Hammett got drafted into the U.S. Army in June of 1918. He was sent to basic training and then assigned to the Motor Ambulance Corps. Ironically, also not that different from Ernest Hemingway, who he would resemble in some ways in both his works and his life. Reportedly, he flipped an ambulance, Hammett did, flipped an ambulance over when it was filled with wounded soldiers, and I think that he would allude to this being traumatizing, and he hated driving for the rest of his life. On top of that, influenza ravaged the armed forces, including through the U.S. Army. Some estimate, like pretty convincingly, that more soldiers died from influenza than from combat. Dashiell Hammett caught influenza and, as a complication from that, got permanent disabling tuberculosis. For the rest of his life, Hammett would be varying levels of disabled by tuberculosis, ranging from entirely disabled to mostly fine. Like, his daughter said, his illness caused him to conclude that it was useless to take care of yourself. He told me that the guys in the army hospital who followed the doctor's orders got lots of rest and good night's sleep, did worse than those who, like himself, sneaked out to town and smoked, drank, and held around when they could. He believed that the disease respected toughness, a quality that my father greatly admired, unquote. Hammett went back to the Pinkerton Agency after the war for more detective work, when his health allowed. After a particularly bad flare-up of tuberculosis, Hammett was sent to a military VA hospital in Tacoma, Washington, in 1920. That is where he would meet a young nurse who would become his wife, Josephine Dolan. They had a romance, and they got married in July 1921. They moved to San Francisco, which would be the setting to one of his greatest novels, The Maltese Falcon. Now, tuberculosis sounds like an awful disease. I know that sounds cavalier and dumb, because of course it was, but apparently a big part of it was that you would frequently feel fine, and you would go back to, like, your normal job and try to do it, and then just, like, drop dead. And there's, like, a pretty large number of people who tried to do that and died. Like, it's freaking crazy. I imagine it would be very hard to deal with if you were already lazy and disinclined to work, but also, you know, disability checks not being large enough or consistent or livable, like, really puts you in a weird situation. There's a somewhat better record of Hammett's time working for the Pinkertons after World War I. This is mostly due to the fact that, like, we know who his supervisor was, and that guy went on to work for the Secret Service, and he would be interviewed, you know, about the time they spent working together. Now, it was around this time, after World War I, that Hammett was assigned to work the Fatty Arbuckle case. Hammett thought Arbuckle was innocent of manslaughter, but then again, he was working for Arbuckle, so take that, of course, with a grain of salt. Hammett, for what it's worth, thought that Arbuckle had been framed by a crooked DA and unscrupulous journalists. At this point, I don't actually know what to think of the Fatty Arbuckle case. I have a hard time seeing myself ever caring enough to really figure out what was going on. I've heard a lot of things one way or the other. Hammett would write about interacting with Arbuckle, saying, I sat in the lobby of the Plaza Hotel in San Francisco. It was the day before the opening of the second absurd attempt to convict Roscoe Arbuckle of something. He came into the lobby. He looked at me and I at him. His eyes were the eyes of a man who expected to be regarded as a monster, but was not yet inured to it. I made my gaze as contemptuous as I could. He glared at me, went on to the elevator, still glaring. It was amusing. I was working for his attorneys at the time, gathering evidence for his defense. Now later on, Hammett would tell people he headed the Arbuckle investigation, which is almost certainly one of the textbook cases of embellishing a story. He probably did work on the case, but it is doubtful that he was heading the investigation. Either way, Hammett stopped scabbing and sleuthing for the Pinkertons by 1922. I should state, as well, that Dashiell Hammett was never at any point in his life particularly faithful to Josephine Dolan, or even the women he cheated on her with. He would frequently pay for sex workers. He was definitely a dirtbag in that regard, for sure. Now, according to Hammett, I decided to become a writer. It was a good idea, having no experience whatsoever in writing, except writing letters and reports. I wasn't handicapped by exaggerated notions of the difficulties ahead. Unquote. Hammett also said, through a short fiction story, I'm not what you call, mind you, this is the character saying it, I'm not what you call a brilliant thinker. Such results as I get are usually the fruits of patience, industry, and unimaginative plugging, helped out now and then, maybe, by a little luck. But I do have my flashes of intelligence, unquote. Which again, damn, just like me for real. In 1922, around when Hammett quit the agency, there's this great story of William Pinkerton, the son of Alan Pinkerton, who William Pinkerton at that point ran the agency, visiting San Francisco for the International Convention of Police Chiefs. The press asked him a whole number of questions, including what he thought about detective stories. William Pinkerton shouted, "They're bunk and rot. Have you ever read a detective story that read like the person who wrote it knew what he was talking about? Never, and I don't expect to." Unquote. Mind you, that's before Hammett had really gotten into the detective story game. William Pinkerton especially disliked Sherlock Holmes. He said to these journalists, "These stories about detectives tracing crimes by scratches on the back of watches and all that sort of rot give the people the wrong idea about the way we work. Detective work is only using good common sense, nothing else. Any man with good common sense can be a detective. I've picked some of my men from streetcars and all sorts of occupations, and they have usually made good," unquote. Which, yeah, I mean, that seems to be true, right? Prior to Hammett, detective stories were very much more in the vein of, like, British fancy lads and ladies solving incredibly complicated plots through their wits. There would be tons of clues in the stories. There'd be like closed room murders, murder mysteries, dinner murder mysteries. Like, that wouldn't just be like the most horrifying thing in real life. Things of this nature, right? Weirdly sanitized murder, like, you know, murder plots that like wrap up neatly. You know, mystery novels that work like a well-made clock, things of this nature. Hammett explained his thoughts on detective stories. He said, "I'm one of the few people moderately literate who take the detective story seriously." He also wrote, "Someday somebody's going to make literature of it, and I'm selfish enough to have my hopes." Now, I, and just about everyone out there, think that he succeeded, right? Raymond Chandler, attesting to Hammett's success in achieving those hopes, wrote an essay about what Hammett would do with his fiction. Chandler said. Hammett took murder out of the Venetian vase and dropped it in the alley. Hammett wrote at first and almost to the end, four people with a sharp, aggressive attitude to life. They were not afraid of the seamy side of things. They lived there. Hammett gave murder back to the kind of people who commit it for reasons, not just to provide a corpse. He was spare, frugal, hard-boiled, but he did over and over again what only the best writers can ever do at all. He wrote scenes that seemed to have never been written before. Unquote. Ironically, though, Hammett didn't just start with detective fiction, mysteries, or crime. He actually started with what he would later call legit fiction. He was writing stories much more in the vein of, like, literary fiction, like stuff that would fit in the smart set rather than Black Mask. A lot of people have compared Hammett's early stuff to Sherwood Anderson. He did not start off with hard-boiled detective fiction. Now, I'm not going to go through Hammett's publishing history necessarily. You can just read the Wikipedia for that. It's interesting, but it is funny that Hammett initially viewed publishing in Black Mask magazine as slumming it. Black Mask, for those who don't know, was dedicated to crime fiction. Hammett did like publishing in Black Mask because it paid well, relatively. Over time, Hammett found that, you know, mentioning that he had been Pinkerton man helped his cred, his credibility, so he more and more started leaning into it. He said, quote, I found I could sell the stories easily when it became known that I had been a Pinkerton man. People thought my stuff was authentic, unquote. Still, success and genius, truly quality stuff, would not strike yet. Now, in some ways, I think you could view Dashiell Hammett's life trajectory almost like, it's almost like he was dragging himself out of the sleaze, out of the swamp, of disreputable job to disreputable job, until he managed to die with some degree of dignity. Hammett knew how to write, and he couldn't literally, like, he physically could not do anything else anyway. So, to that end, in the mid-1920s, Hammett became an advertising man for a diamond jeweler in San Francisco. Again, maybe it, like, this is probably better than being a Pinkerton, but, like, not by a ton, right? He worked for Albert Samuels Jewelers. This jeweler advertised heavily in newspapers. They were, you know, this was, like, the early days of advertising, so they were trying all kinds of stuff. They, for instance, this jeweler sponsored classified ads trying to reunite people with lost jewelry. That got them a lot of positive press. They would also try to write ads which would tell an emotional story. Now, if there's one thing Hammett didn't have at this time, regarding his jobs, that is, it was scruples. And he did not look down on the type of work that he did, whether it was writing fiction, whether it was writing detective fiction, whether it was being a Pinkerton or being an ad man, right? And he, by all accounts, did not look down on writing copy. Not to say that he glamorized it either or romanticized it. At this job, you know, he met Albert Samuels, right? And Samuels would stay friends with Hammett, like, for the rest of his life. Hammett would actually dedicate his novel, The Dane Curse, to Samuels. The Dane Curse features, not prominently, but, like, there is a whole diamond angle to the mystery. So that's interesting. So, mind you, I'm not including, like, the short stories, which extended before and after, but starting in 1929, Hammett went on a truly insane spree, which is to say he wrote Red Harvest in 1929, The Dane Curse in 1930, The Maltese Falcon in 1930, The Glass Key in 1931, and then he wrote The Thin Man in 1934. Like, that is an incredibly productive, incredibly solid run in a pretty short amount of time. And then he just stopped writing novels after that. But pound for pound, that's some of the best work in the shortest amount of time. No filler, no skips. Solid. Nothing but bangers. It's interesting. Here's my theory, okay? Each of Hammett's different protagonists sort of hides his true convictions. Like, almost like he's guarding them. The Continental Op hides behind his job, his duty, right? Like, but nevertheless, the Continental Op character will frequently stretch the definitions of his job, even breaking the rules of his job sometimes, to encompass his own moral code. The character Sam Spade hides his convictions behind cynicism and a sneer. He would say to a character, "Don't be too sure I'm as crooked as I'm supposed to be," to a character that was underestimating him. The character Nick Charles of The Thin Man hides behind a pose of disinterest and drunkenness. Now, it's my contention that all of these poses were Hammett at different stages of life. Like, the Continental Op very clearly would be something akin to Hammett working at the Pinkertons. Sam Spade, maybe also at the Pinkertons, but maybe in a different era. Nick Charles of The Thin Man, of course, that would be Hammett a little later on when he's achieved literary success and he's, you know, partying hard. But in every case, Hammett's characters feel the need to hide their convictions but never relinquish them, and to ultimately stand by those convictions against what is essentially a corrupt world. But that sort of begs the question, what did Hammett believe or care about? We'll get to that in a minute. Now, it's an ironic fluke that as America sank into the Great Depression, Dashiell Hammett found himself incredibly rich. Paramount Studios had acquired the rights to Red Harvest, which would come out in butchered form as Roadhouse Nights in 1930. Side note, for my money, and this is again not exactly like a hot take, but for my money, Yojimbo is by far the best loose adaptation of Red Harvest, followed by A Fistful of Dollars. Blood Simple and Brick are also, you know, good, but they're too far from the plot to be called adaptations, rather than like spiritual cousins or something. So Paramount acquired the rights to The Maltese Falcon, which would be adapted in 1941, starring, of course, Humphrey Bogart and Mary Astor. Goes without saying that the novel and the film are two of the best of their respective genres to ever do it, and it's probably one of the best examples where, like, the novel and the film are, like, equally as good. That's rare, I think, that, like, both are in their respective genres, like, the best versions that are out there. If you haven't seen The Maltese Falcon, please, please, go out and see it, go out and read it. Give yourself a little treat, and don't get me started on the Maltese connection. I read two books about Dashiell Hammett in order to partially figure out where on earth he was getting the Maltese connection. Still have no clue. There's absolutely no indication as to why he would have been like Knights of Malta build, if he was at all, actually. Like, I don't know, maybe talking to some Pinkertons or something. Like, I don't really know where he got it from, but there's so much to that. And, like, I might have to go down a few more rabbit holes to nail that down. But so Hammett was hired by Paramount Studios. They didn't just acquire the rights to some of his novels. They also hired him to come on as a scriptwriter to write original stories for them. It's interesting because he entered the game at a high level, so he didn't necessarily have to grind out scripts the way that, like, a lot of screenwriters would. Like, Dalton Trumbo, for instance, entered at a low level and had to grind his way to the top. Hammett sort of like skipped all that. That said, as Hammett became kind of a party animal and kind of a just drunk, it's surprising actually how much normal script writing, normal straightforward work he actually got accomplished. So while Hammett was partying and working in Hollywood, he met a script reader for MGM named Lillian Kober, aka Lillian Hellman. She was 12 years his junior. They quickly became lovers. Hellman was an aspiring writer herself, and Hammett knew talent and respected her abilities. It's funny because Hammett was on the one hand a womanizer, but on the other hand, he supported Hellman's work and they collaborated on an equal footing. Well, like, he mentored her writing and by all means was actually genuinely like supportive of her writing. So Hellman would become the first woman to be nominated for an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Shortly after Hammett's incredibly productive spree of novels, Hellman went on a stretch herself, writing several Broadway plays, which became successful. Hellman, of course, writing Broadway plays meant that she was never probably as famous to like the rest of the country, but by all means, you know, she's well known. And like I said, Hammett mentored her work at first, but she absolutely stood on her own as a writer. Like many authors, Hammett found that Hollywood was not actually conducive to getting meaningful work done, and in fact was probably an impediment. The only real work he accomplished other than script writing and some short stories was The Thin Man. Now this might be a controversial opinion, but I think the film adaptation of The Thin Man was superior to the novel. It's still a credit to him that he came up with the characters and so forth, but for my money, The Glass Key was the last great novel that Hammett wrote. Though I will maintain also that The Thin Man movie is very fun to watch. I do recommend people watch it. It is much more lighthearted. It's funny too. To celebrate the publication of The Thin Man, Hammett and Hellman traveled to Miami, and there's this really funny story of Hammett, almost certainly drunk, getting arrested for throwing a brick through the window of a department store. He was just acting a fool. In 1935, Hammett met Gertrude Stein at a party which included Charlie Chaplin. It's very likely that he met Charlie Chaplin. Hammett knew just about everyone in that era of Hollywood. He knew Walt Disney. Now there's this anecdote, right? And maybe people know, maybe they don't, but there's this famous Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood. It has a very distinctive, like, dome, looks like a Brown Derby. You can Google it, it's pretty interesting. So Hammett and Hellman were eating there at the famous Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, and they were eating there, and a homeless man came in, snuck in, right, past the maitre d', and he was, you know, doing a hustle, trying to sell postcards. And Hammett said, "How much do you want?" You know, pulling out his wallet to give this homeless man money. I think the story, there's an implication that the homeless man was like kind of a con artist and kind of crazy. Hammett gave the man $100. Mind you, this is like in the 30s. And Hellman asked why Hammett gave that guy so much money, when Hammett clearly didn't like him and also, like, didn't want any postcards and thought that he was, like Hammett clearly didn't like the guy. And Hammett replied, "Because no good stinkers get hungry, too." Which, if that isn't a good motto to live by, I don't know what is. So in 1936, Hammett taught creative writing for a time at Princeton. He also worked in Hollywood still. He also spent time writing for a comic strip that would appear in newspapers known as Secret Agent X9. He also wrote radio plays. So like, while you can sort of read into his career something like, oh, like, Hollywood washed him out, he became too alcoholic, and he never produced. Like, he was still creating media, he was still productive, it's just he wasn't making what I think, maybe this is my bias, but, like, what most people would value, which is, like, high-quality novels. But what are you gonna do? Around this time, Hammett and Hellman joined the Screenwriters Guild, SWG, which was a quasi-union. Hammett, despite being one of the highest-paid screenwriters, believed in the goals of the Screenwriters Guild, which was to say, protecting the largely underpaid screenwriters. Hammett, despite his Pinkerton past, or perhaps because of it, actually had a hidden egalitarian streak, and this would come out more and more during his time in Hollywood. Hammett took leadership roles in the Screenwriters Guild. In 1935, Hammett joined the League of American Writers, LAW, which had been founded by the Communist Party, in order to circle America's left-wing wagons against the Nazi menace. In 1936, Hammett sent the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which is to say the International Brigade, he sent them $500. Hammett also mostly talked, about wanting to go fight in Spain, but he was not allowed to. Hellman would, in fact, go to Spain to assist with the documentary The Spanish Earth. Now, it's funny, a lot of people, even people who, like, maybe know some stuff about the Spanish Civil War, don't necessarily know the documentary The Spanish Earth, which is crazy, because, like, it was a big deal. Tons of people were involved, including Ernest Hemingway, who provided voiceover work, John Dos Passos, and get this, Orson Welles also provided narration. In the French version, Jean Renoir narrated the film. And Hellman, of course, was involved in making it, along with a bunch of other, like, leftists. Dashiell Hammett would go on to be the president of the League of American Writers in 1941. Hammett and Hellman joined the Communist Party, the CPUSA, sometime in 1936 or 1937. In letters to his daughter, Hammett referred to himself as a Red. Hellman would later write that Hammett was a Marxist. In 1937, Hammett spoke at a League of American Writers symposium on the topic, "Should Writers Mix in Politics?" Hammett argued that writers should. In 1938, Hammett became the elected chairman of the Motion Pictures Artist Committee, which raised money for anti-fascist causes. By the way, inexplicably, in researching this episode, just as I found a bunch of English professor types arguing that Hammett almost certainly did not get the offer to murder Frank Little, these same authors argued that Hammett and Hellman were tricked into joining the Communist Party, or were otherwise good liberals who were hoodwinked by the Communist Party. They argue, with literally no evidence, that Hammett and Hellman were not intending to be in the Communist Party. And they pretty much use the line of reasoning that, like, certain actors would use, which was, like, rightfully or wrongfully just being like, hey, I accidentally went to a Communist Party meeting, like, one time. I didn't join. I'm sorry. You know, typical Red Scare bullshit. But, like, there were a ton of people for whom that was true. Like, hey, I didn't know these guys were communists. Or, like, okay, like, I accidentally went to a meeting once. Like, there's all kinds of people for whom, you know, that's true. Hammett and Hellman were not in that camp. They joined the Communist Party. They joined a bunch of groups associated with the Communist Party. They were in leadership. They were involved. They sent money. Like, they knew exactly what they were doing. They referred to themselves as Reds and Marxists. There's absolutely no evidence that they were not witting Reds, right? Here's a good example from the book Dashiell Hammett, Man of Mystery, by Sally Klein. It's a perfect example of the type of bullshit I'm talking about. And I quote, "What the Communist Party meant to Lily," that's Lily and Hellman, "meant to Lily and Dash at that point was not what was later understood by party membership. It did not necessarily include any desire or obligation to overthrow the U.S. government or to practice acts of subversion as it had in the 20s. By the late 30s, the Communist International Policymaking Body had started an initiative called the Popular Front, which focused on civil rights issues, women's rights issues, equal rights for minorities, and causes for well-known individuals who had been wronged politically. This attracted liberals into the party, as did the enthusiasm for the cause of Republican Spain. Franco, of course, was supported by fascists in Germany and Italy. Hammett and other liberal celebrities were seduced to the cause of anti-fascism," unquote. Absolutely wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. I mean, she's not wrong about the Popular Front attracting a bunch of well-meaning Hollywood liberals into the party. Like, that did happen. What I'm disputing is that they didn't know what the Communist Party was, that they weren't about it, as the term goes. It is frankly absurd to call Hammett and Hellman liberal celebrities seduced by the cause of anti-fascism. Like, absolute bullshit. Frankly, malfeasance on the part of Sally Klein. Like, I realize I pick very low, obscure grudges against authors when I'm researching, but, like, Sally Klein just doesn't know shit. I'm sorry. So after Pearl Harbor, at the age of 48, tuberculosis-ridden still, Dashiell Hammett enlisted in the U.S. Army, where he was trained in signals and cryptanalysis. Now, I know what you're thinking. Jimmy, why aren't you freaking out? Signals intelligence. I know. Hammett worked doing cryptanalysis on an Aleutian island, but due to his radical views, they eventually transferred him, where he became an editor of an army newspaper, the Adakian. For a time, they also had him editing and writing training manuals as well. While he was serving, Hammett began to have teeth trouble, so he visited a dentist. No, I'm not about to give you a heart attack, dear listener. His teeth were actually infected, so they actually pulled most or maybe all of his teeth, actually, and he had to get dentures. You thought I was going somewhere else with that, huh? So, Hellman purchased an estate in upstate New York called Hardscrabble Farm. The plan was to get away from Hollywood, which wasn't good for either of them, to get closer to New York City, which is where Hellman was spending more and more of her time. Obviously, she wrote Broadway plays. And Hammett was just getting to be an old man, so they wanted to have a quieter life in general. They lived there. Hammett grew fat. They bred poodles. At one point, they had 15 dogs, you know, in a farm way, not like a crazy dog person kind of way. Hammett found time to teach at the Jefferson School of Social Science. What's that, you might say? Because I know most of you are probably not way up on CPUSA history. The Jefferson School of Social Science was a school that the Communist Party ran in Manhattan. Like, adult education, I think it was, like, non-accredited, or, like, that, you know, it was more, like, oriented around, like, enriching people's lives rather than, like, credentialing them type of thing. I could be wrong on that, but Hammett would teach there. He would also serve on the school's board of trustees until the school closed in 1956. You know, well-meaning liberal who not only served in leadership in a half dozen Communist Party groups, but also taught at the Communist Party school, was on their board of trustees. Yeah, Hammett very, very much hoodwinked, right? Also notable that the FBI surveilled and infiltrated the Jefferson School. So the FBI was probably tracking Hammett before this point, but we know for a fact that they had a file on him by at least 1946, which is quite early, I should state. His FBI record shows him working as New York State President for the Civil Rights Congress. The Civil Rights Congress was classified as a subversive organization by no less than the Attorney General and the FBI. You know why they were classified as subversive? For the act of supporting causes like the Martinsville Seven, Rosa Lee Ingram, you know, other terribly subversive causes like that. The FBI surveilled and filled the CRC with snitches and infiltrators as well. In 1947, Hammett called for the abolition of the Un-American House Committee. He was also named a communist by anti-communists within the Actors' Equity Association. Hammett supported Hellman's efforts to organize the Scientific and Cultural Conference for World Peace. Hellman was doing that along with other luminaries like Dmitri Shostakovich, Leonard Bernstein, Albert Einstein, Norman Mailer, Thomas Mann, and Arthur Miller. Hammett and Hellman had a nice, comfortable, happy life together until the hard times came. The hard times, of course, was the second Red Scare.
We're living in a country that's the finest place on earth, but some folks don't appreciate this land that gave them birth. I hear that up in Washington they're having an awful fuss, 'cause communists and spies were making monkeys out of us. The bureaus and departments have been busy night and day. They're figuring out just how we gave our secrets all away. And Congress has appointed a committee, so they said, to find out who's American and who's a low-down red. They call them up to Washington to speak for Uncle Sam, but when they ask them what they are, they shut up like a clam. I wish they'd take and put me on the witness stand today. I'd yell so loud old Stalin could hear me all the way.
I'm no communist, I'll tell you that right now. I believe a man should own his own house and car and cow.
I like this private ownership, I want to be left alone. Let the government run its business and let me run my own. Our government is bigger than it ever was today. The more they hire to work for it, the more they have to pay. Our public servants should be proud and honest, you would think, instead of taking bribes and dressing up their wives in mink. The taxes keep on going up, of that there is no doubt, but still they just can't take it in as fast as they dish it out. Our national debt is a monster size and growing every day. Our children's children, still unborn, are gonna have to pay. Our dollar used to be the soundest money on this earth, but now $2 won't even buy a good old dollar's worth. Unless we stop inflation and take care of what we've got, the communists may win the fight and never fire a shot.
I'm no communist, I'll tell you that right now. I believe a man should own his own house and car and cow.
I like this private ownership, I want to be left alone. Let the government run its business and let me run my own.
Now, we all know something about McCarthy, or at least my American listeners probably know something about McCarthy, the Red Scare, the House Un-American Affairs Committee, known as HUAC, you know, fears of the Iron Curtain, the dangers of Soviet communism, things of this nature. So in 1947, the Hollywood Ten, which included Dalton Trumbo, were subpoenaed to appear in front of Congress, with many of them refusing to name names. The Hollywood Ten would be indicted in 1948 and given that rarest and most white-collar of crimes, contempt of Congress. In relation to that, the Southern District of New York was given the lead role in prosecuting the CPUSA, and they went on to indict the top 12 leaders of the CPUSA in July 1948. This, of course, was a political prosecution. Four of the 12 jumped bail and went underground. In relation to that, in July 1951, federal agents raided Hardscrabble Farm, Hellman and Hammett's home. They were acting on information from a confidential source who said that those four communists who jumped bail might be hiding out there. This, of course, was spurious, but it wasn't completely crazy because Hammett was one of three trustees for the CRC's bail fund. The bail fund existed to bail out politically, you know, prosecuted Reds, right? The trustees were Dashiell Hammett as chairman, Robert W. Dunn, and Frederick Vanderbilt Field, the Silver Spoon Vanderbilt. You may recall him coming up in the Marilyn Monroe thread I did on Twitter. Frederick Vanderbilt Field was a very interesting guy. Now, the feds, when they raided this farm, they interrogated Hammett. They found no fugitives, no evidence that there were fugitives, and they left. But it was a sign of things to come. The Attorney General would later designate the CRC a communist front group, such as it is. In response to the four men continuing to be fugitives, the Southern District of New York issued subpoenas for the trustees of the CRC bail fund. You know, the three guys I just mentioned. They hauled Dashiell Hammett in to testify. A guy named Irving Sapol, a lawyer, was called the nation's number one legal hunter of top communists. And this guy was the chief prosecutor. Sapol would later also be chief prosecutor against the Rosenbergs, by the way. Sapol was the guy questioning Hammett. And the point of these things was not necessarily to get information to find those four men who jumped bail. No, the point was really to publicly humiliate and break these communists. The night before the hearing, Lillian Hellman asked Hammett why he wouldn't just testify that he didn't know the names of the contributors to the bail fund. Hammett mostly didn't. Hammett said, "I can't say that." Hellman asked, "Why?" Hammett replied, "I don't know why. I guess it has something to do with keeping my word, but I don't want to talk about that. I hate this damn kind of talk, but maybe I'd better tell you that if it were more than jail, if it were my life, I would give it for what I think democracy is. And I don't let cops or judges tell me what I think democracy is." Unquote. So on July 9th, 1951, Hammett was compelled to testify in court. Sapol wanted, pressed him, demanded a list of contributors to the bail fund, as well as people who Hammett thought might harbor the fugitives. Hammett got on the stand, gave his own name, and then refused to give anyone else's names. What's more, he refused to identify his own signature on CRC bail fund documents, and he was found guilty of contempt of court. Hammett was immediately taken in by federal marshals, and a judge, a different judge, asked him if he had anything to say before being sentenced. Hammett said, "Not a thing." They sentenced him to 6 months of prison. They took him right away. Hammett was sent off to Ashland, West Virginia, to serve in the federal penitentiary there. I'm pretty certain, actually, that this is also where Dalton Trumbo served time. According to Hellman, Hammett was assigned to clean toilets while he was there. Things did not get better for him after prison, either. Like I said, 6 months, Hammett was out. But He refused to recant or reform or name names or cooperate in any way. So onto the blacklist he went. His radio shows were canceled. The IRS started. They got on his ass. And so, as well, many of his books went out of print. The publishing company, full of cowards, stopped publishing Dashiell Hammett. After a certain point, Hammett was completely broke. By the way, I say for the listeners here, the prisoner sentence and financial ruin that Hammett faced, that is unfortunately a good indication that Hammett was sincere and not an infiltrator into the CPUSA. That and all the time and money that he contributed to the party. Lord knows if you, my listeners, were not at least a little bit suspicious of him doing a seemingly sudden heel turn, or whatever, and suddenly coming out in favor of communism. If you weren't at least a little bit suspicious, I wouldn't be doing my job. But I will say that I have no indications that he was spying. And, like I said, the financial ruin and jail time support the idea that this was in fact a genuine, like, these were genuinely his beliefs. So, amazingly, the witch hunt wasn't over, and HUAC called him in to testify. The previous one, of course, was not HUAC, that was just the Southern District of New York. This time, this was for a national stage. Hammett was forced to testify before Joseph McCarthy's HUAC on March 26, 1953. They asked him whether he thought communism was a superior form of government to what the United States had at the time. Hammett said he couldn't give a definite answer. Then they asked him whether he favored adopting communism in the United States, and Hammett said no. They needled and pressed him as to why, and Hammett said it would be impractical, as most people opposed communism. They had broken Hammett enough to engage with them, but not enough to name names. In 1955, HUAC called on Hammett yet again. And this time, he had some of that fire back. This time, he said, "Communism to me is not a dirty word. When you're working for the advancement of mankind, it never occurs to you if the guy's a communist or not." Through the 1950s, Hammett was in poor health, and he was no longer popular. He was also broke, so he became something of a homebody and a hermit. He would die in 1961 due to complications from lung cancer. Dashiell Hammett was buried in Arlington National Cemetery according to his wishes. Let's take stock of Dashiell Hammett's life. There's a long list of failings. He was an alcoholic. He was a womanizer. He smoked excessively on top of tuberculosis. He could be cruel. He abandoned his wife. He was an advertising man. He lost inspiration and couldn't keep writing, you know, mind-blowing novels. He wasted his money. The list goes on and on. But what can we learn from a life like Dashiell Hammett's? There are a lot of lessons, I think, but one that sticks out to me is the idea that people can change. It's not always clean. People zigzag. They go in fits and starts. They backslide. But people are not irredeemable. A former Pinkerton thug, a strikebreaker, a scab. People like Hammett can change their ways. And by the end of his life, Dashiell Hammett managed to stand up for something and die with some dignity. I do genuinely think that Hammett was freaked out by what he saw in Butte, Montana. And he hated that he was in a position where someone ever might have thought that he would commit murder for money. I think it made him question his life, and society as a whole. I don't think he was cynical about detective work. I think he thought detective work was fine. I think he was cynical about what the detective work was being used for, which is, to me, the more logical thing. I think he was very cynical about society. I think his experiences made him question his life, his choices, and society as a whole. For many years, he seemed to be incredibly cynical about his own life and about society. The novel The Glass Key, for instance, has some of the most incisive explanations of how old party politics work in a city. It's incredibly sordid yet realistic. I think for many years, Hammett did not see a way out. And then, in Hollywood in the 1930s, at the peak of his professional and financial success, Dashiell Hammett found radical politics. It flies in the face of conventional wisdom, and even some vulgar Marxist understandings of how class ought to work, but nevertheless, Hammett identified with the Communist Party. He had a egalitarian working class understanding of how society ought to be, what a fair shake meant. From that point, Hammett threw himself into active party politics. He leveraged, and from a certain point of view, wasted, or certainly, like, spent, to his own detriment, his fame and fortune, supporting various good causes. Then, Hammett was cut down, thrown into the buzzsaw, made an example of by the second Red Scare. Hammett would be the first to tell you, probably, if I had to guess, Hammett would be the first to tell you that he was not morally superior to alcoholics like McCarthy, to craven opportunists like the Kennedys, and to the whole range of, like, journalists, federal thugs, and so forth. Hammett would have been the first to say he wasn't morally superior to them, but Hammett did know what justice was. He knew what a fair shake was. He knew what the average working man actually went through. And all those people who judged him did not know that. Towards the end of his life, Hammett stood against the Pinkertons and the bosses on the side of workers and suffered the consequences. Although he was on the wrong side earlier in his life, Hammett ended up in the right place. And to me, that is both an interesting and heartwarming story. To be a good detective, it takes a keen, insightful eye. And then to be a good author of crime fiction, some of the greatest crime fiction ever written, Hammett used a keen, insightful eye. He used that analytical ability to write, like I said, some of the greatest crime fiction ever written. The same insights that made him a good detective and a great crime author were used to help him come to the conclusion that he needed to fight to make society better. Now, at a certain point, as I was writing these episodes, I thought about why I was doing an episode on Dashiell Hammett and not Frank Little. The easy answer, and short answer, is that there's more information on Hammett than Little, and, like, I've engaged so much more with Hammett's, like, novels and so forth, which are some of my favorite of all time. But I think it's easy to mythologize someone like Frank Little, even though Little was clearly a three-dimensional real person. Like, it's hard to, like, cast him as, like, a Superman or something, but, like, I'm not necessarily interested in telling the story of, like, people who I think are just clearly good. I focused on Dashiell Hammett precisely because he's a damaged fuck-up. He shows us people can change. You can change. You, dear listener, can change. You can fight for a better society. No matter what you've done, you can change and make society better. It won't be easy. Sometimes it might even entail colossal sacrifices, like going broke or going to prison. Dashiell Hammett did it. Lord knows he didn't want to. And Lord knows you won't be rewarded for it. You won't be more, Like, you won't reap financial success from being on the right side of history. It's still worth doing, because at the end of the day, Dashiell Hammett probably died with something close to a clean conscience. And do you really feel that way about the murderers of Frank Little, about the owners of Anaconda Copper, about the bosses, you know, about the guys running the Pinkerton agency? Lord knows, do you think that Joseph McCarthy died with a clean conscience? Like, no. At the end of the day, Hammett wrote that the detective is motivated by honor, and we still live in a dishonorable society, so the detective has to keep his guard up, to hide behind maybe a few poses, maybe to hide behind cynicism. But at the end of the day, what you care about and believe in is more important, and it is worth sacrificing for it. That is the story of Dashiell Hammett. And of course, Frank Little died for what he believed in. So, very much a related story, I think. Four sources today. Of course, I used the book Dashiell Hammett, Man of Mystery by Sally Klein. I do not recommend it. I think it was bad. I still used it for information. Sally Klein should stick to writing about Zelda Fitzgerald and other apolitical things. She does not know much about radical politics, and it does make me question her judgment. A much better book on Dashiell Hammett was The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett by Nathan Ward. It's decent. It's only a partial biography. It doesn't go through his whole life, but it's pretty solid. And then a hard recommend on the book Always on Strike, Frank Little and the Western Wobblies by Arnold Stead. Hard recommend. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. I need to be on my way. You're already on Patreon, so just tell a friend about the show. Check out the merch, by the way. There is merch now. See you next episode, and God bless.
There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone, and you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone. And I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. Won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be running from the rain when I'm gone. And I can't even suffer from the pain when I'm gone. Can't say who's to praise and who's to blame when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. Won't see the golden of the sun when I'm gone. And the evenings and the mornings will be one when I'm gone. Can't be singing louder than the guns while I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. All my days won't be dances of delight when I'm gone. And the sands will be shifting from my sight when I'm gone. Can't add my name into the fight while I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be laughing at the lies when I'm gone. And I can't question how or when or why when I'm gone. Can't live proud enough to die when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.